the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, and today we rebroadcast a show for you with, starting with, biologist and paleontologist Neil Shubin. As the polar ice melts, Shubin explores the contents within and uncovers mysteries in his new book, Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Then science journalist Olivia Campbell shares how four women physicists escaped Nazi Germany and made scientific history in her new book, Sisters in Science. That all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
From meteorites frozen in Antarctica to ancient viruses reanimating in melting glaciers to a quote-unquote dinosaur dance floor where creatures trampled once tropical polar landscapes and more. And as the ice melts, it can reveal so much about our future. This is what we discussed this morning with renowned scientist, explorer, and sought-after science communicator Neil Shubin. We're pleased to have him join us today to discuss his new book, just out, Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Neil, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Neil, when I first heard about the possibility of viruses sort of hiding in ice, and as the ice melts, these viruses released into the air, I thought it was fiction that I had seen on TV. And I find out from you that indeed it is not fiction and it's real. It's not only interesting, a little scary, but very compelling. I'm wondering how you first became compelled with finding out what goes on in the ice.
Well, I was pulled to polar regions because I was studying as a paleontologist, looking for fossils that tell us about the history of life. And I was given the opportunity as a student. This is like in 1988. Okay, I was three. So it was in 1988. And I was part of a four-person team to go to East Greenland to look for dinosaurs. And I never really camped before. I never had outdoor experience. And here I am, 6 weeks, Greenland, living in a tent, you know, below freezing. It was quite the experience. But that kicked off about almost four decades of polar research in both the North and Southern polar regions. And the places have just gotten in my blood. These places change the way you see the world. It really does. And when you see the polar landscape and when you communicate with the scientific community in these places who work on everything from meteorites to glaciers to ecology and polar bears and you name it, they change the way they see the world as well. And then what makes those places special is obviously they're at high latitudes. They function at lower energy, a lower amount of solar energy comes in, and ice is the big player there. Ice has been the big player there for a long time. But that ice is so fragile. That ice has come and gone over millennia. In fact, most of the history of our planet is a history of poles without ice. You know, but our history as a species has happened at a time when there's ice at the poles. And that ice is like a library. When it freezes, it contains everything that was around, from atmospheric particles to even ancient air to soot to viruses and other microbes, to, you know, parts of the ancient world. So they're like the ice becomes like a time capsule, right? And as it's melting now, which is happening at an ever increasing rate, we're seeing bits and pieces from the past of the planet emerging again, and viruses and microbes are part of that.
Well, since you mentioned it and your decades long love for discovery, We just have to talk about the Tiktaalik for just a moment that you discovered. There it is. It's the fish with legs. And this was, you looked for what you believe to be something that could be found for 20 years.
Yeah, it was kind of we took a bet, right? So, you know, after those experiences in Greenland, I sort of gained the polar research bug and realized that there's this whole part of the world all the rocks that aren't covered by ice in the polar regions to explore. As a geologist, as a paleontologist, it was like a kid in a candy store. Now, the only thing is I had to, you know, this is a candy store. You need to run big expeditions to buy the candy, you know, if you will. But, yeah, we identified a series of rocks up on Canada's Ellesmere Island and actually throughout the western part of Canada's high Arctic as well that were perfect. They were the right age, about 380 million years old, 375 million years old. They were the right type. They were formed in ancient rivers and streams in the distant past to hold these fossils. So we did a series of expeditions, and we were failures for a number of years until in 2004, we found fossils of a fish, and again, in rocks about 375 to 380 million years old, a fish with fins and scales in its back, just like any good old fish. But it had gills as well, but it had lungs. And it had inside the fin, it had bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearm, even parts of our wrist, as well as other stuff, you know, that relates to land living creatures. So here was a real mix. So when we found that, the team was just elated, and I was relieved because it took us for a long time. And I had, you know, placed a lot of bets on finding this thing, and with my colleagues, obviously, it's teamwork to do it. But yeah, it was really something.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with author and explorer and paleontologist Neil Shubin and his new book, Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. Well, Neil, I am always fascinated by these deep, deep lakes that are under miles of ice that we've never explored. Have we been able to go into any of these bodies of water and actually find new things?
Well, you're not the only people who are fascinated. I mean, can you imagine the Russian, there was basically Russian, French, and American teams that did these drilling projects in the middle of the Antarctic ice cap, okay? So Antarctica is larger than the continental United States, and much of that is ice. So think of an ice block that's miles thick, the size, a little bit bigger than the United States. Did a drilling project to 2.5 miles beneath the surface. And this is back in the 90s, they found a lake that's about the size of the great, one of the smaller Great Lakes here in the Midwest, about 2.5 miles under the ice. And there are about 400 of those lakes under the ice of Antarctica, okay? And they've sampled that. So it's pretty tricky business to do that. So you do not want to, these are pristine environments that have been separated from the surface for millions or millennia to maybe millions of years. And so it takes some high technology. The National Science Foundation of the United States, the U.S. Antarctic Program, has run a program to sample the water in these lakes. But boy, does it take some high technology. They have to treat the drill bits with UV light, make sure we're not contaminating what's going on down there. They have to be very careful to have these things sealed up so there's no lubricants or other chemicals, because drilling's a very dirty process. And they have to design robots that are sterile, that can sample underneath the ice itself. And my goodness, I mean, the ingenuity that's behind this. This is one of the things in writing this book that just blew me away. The human ingenuity to be able to sample these places is just mind-blowing. And then what's even more mind-blowing is what we learn. I mean, when they pull up the waters from these places and they sample them with high technology, DNA sequencing, it turns out there are critters in there. There are microbes. Many different kinds of microbes. And oftentimes these microbes have been living independently of the rest of the planet for millennia. You know, and they have whole ecosystems down there that are separated from the light of the sun. You know, so they have all of these novel chemical tricks to live in these low energy environments. And they've been living and evolving independently of the rest of the planet. It's really a remarkable story of science and perseverance and technology and human ingenuity.
Well, Neil, so most of us just think polar ice, and we assume that the ice on the North Pole and the ice on the South Pole are pretty much the same, short of the South Pole having a continent underneath it, which the North Pole does not. What are the differences that people find in those ice caps in terms of scientific research and discoveries?
Right. We're all familiar with ice, right? We know ice in our drinks. We sometimes slip on it and skate on it and do our human activities on it or with it. But imagine ice the size of a state or a whole continent. And it behaves very differently. And in fact, ice is one of the most complicated, surprisingly complicated substances out there, because it, I like to say, and there's a chapter heading in the book, one of the first ones, is called Ice is Hot. And that's a phrase that glaciologists use a lot. Ice is hot? That sounds like a Zen koan, like you'd be meditating to that or something. But no, what it means is that the ice melts at a temperature that's close to the ambient temperature of the environment. It's not like steel, which has a melting point at like 900 degrees or whatever it is. Ice is at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That means it can just, a small change in temperature can move it from liquid to solid and back again. You know, and it's at a knife edge, right? And so the ice in these places is always at the knife edge between melting into water and freezing. And that controls its behavior. It controls its size. It controls how it moves and so forth. So there's a lot of surprises here with ice. And that's kind of what I wanted to capture in the book, which is when you think about Antarctica, much of the melting of the ice doesn't happen on the surface down. It's not like it melts from the top down. Where it really melts fastest, and this is where it gets tricky, is it melts at the coast. It melts where the ice meets the ocean waters or the seawater. And there's where it gets really tricky, because the seawaters are warmer and they cause the melting there. Furthermore, there are parts of the coast of Antarctica that are actually below sea level itself of the continent. So the water will seep underneath these coastal glaciers and melt them from below. So there's all these surprises there. And it's these surprises that are really controlling how much water goes from the ice into the oceans, which controls sea level, ocean, you know, ocean currents, and all this other good, all this other important stuff. But yeah, it's an incredibly dynamic landscape. I mean, these places hold, you know, they're 8% of the surface area of the Earth, but they hold about 70% of the fresh water of the planet. So they're our bank of fresh water. They're our bank of ancient stuff that's been buried, that's been frozen in them from years. This is amazingly important stuff.
Neil, I remember, you know, when the Iceman that was on the border of Austria and Italy was discovered, Utsi, if I'm pronouncing it right, when he was unearthed, or uniced, I guess is the better terminology for that, there was a lot of controversy surrounding this man that was found in the ice. He was incredibly preserved. And these are the kinds of things that you're finding on the polar ice caps, is that A, there's so much in the ice, and B, there is controversy now surrounding, you know, whose ice it is or whose ice it was. How does that affect when you are on a team of scientists, how you go about your work?
So I'm usually part of very international teams. So in the Arctic and Antarctica, we've worked with Canadians and Australians and others. So it's a, you know, it's polar science. The scientific part of this has been very collaborative internationally. It has to be. It takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of human ingenuity of different nations to work together. So in that part, it's really great. The Antarctica is a little different from the Arctic, in that Antarctica, in the late 1950s, there was a treaty that was signed called the Antarctic Treaty. And that treaty basically committed nations to keeping Antarctica an international resource for science. So there's no militarization of an entire continent. There are no military bases there. They're only allowed to have scientific bases. And a number of countries have scientific bases there, including the U.S., Chinese, Russians, Europeans, Koreans, and so forth. The Arctic is very different. The Arctic is chopped up by countries that claim its resources. Canada, Denmark through Greenland, Russia through Siberia, the United States through Alaska, Norway through Svalbard, and on and on and on. Now, what makes the Arctic really tricky, and this is where you're going to be reading about it much more in the coming years, is because it has a geological quirk of nature that makes it internationally tricky. Underneath the North Pole, there's no continent. There's ocean, right? The sea floor underneath the North Pole has a mountain range, a mountain ridge, that extends pretty much from Siberia to Canada and Greenland. And when scientists sample that mountain ridge, it turns out it's part of the continent of each place because of the history of the Earth. That means each country can make a legitimate claim for the entire ocean floor underneath the North Pole, an area several times the size of Texas underneath. And think about that, mineral rights, oil rights, and all that stuff. The Russians have already made a claim to the UN Committee of Law of the Sea. Canadians and Danes have as well. And they're being evaluated as we speak. I think the Russian claim was accepted. It showed the science was true. Now the diplomats will have to get to work. But, you know, there are countries going to be claiming that whole area. And I think a lot of attention is going to be, increasing attention is going to be going north and south in the coming decades.
So that makes me wonder about the degree to which you can correlate the ice cap with the ocean floor and how much it shifts and moves and things like that. So can you ever, from the top, know where you're exploring, essentially?
Well, satellites can see inside the ice. It's amazing. If I was just down in Southern California talking to folks, talking to somebody at JPL, you know, Jet Propulsion Laboratory. The technology there is incredible. So satellites can monitor the ice and actually see inside the ice and monitor what's going on with the ice. And in some cases, look at those lakes we talked about before and the water underneath the ice from space. You know, so you can do a lot from space. The technology has gotten ever more increasingly powerful. You can do drilling projects to look inside the ice. You can, as I said, you can drill down and you can make robots that can go underneath the water, autonomous devices, and that technology is increasing ever more. And you can do drilling projects, which are really expensive and really hard to do, but, and that's kind of old school, but it is actually a very powerful way to do it. And when you do those sorts of things, what you find is the polar ice in the Arctic, now we're dealing with the north now, is shrinking very fast. And this is objective. This is just, you can measure it, right? So we have ground stations that measure temperature. We have satellites that can measure temperature. And the Arctic is heating 4 to 7 times faster than anywhere else on the planet. And that's increasing because as that ice melts, it turns to water, and it exposes darker rocks and darker ocean, which release more heat. So the more ice you lose, the more heat you release, and you get into this thing called Arctic amplification. And that's why, to make a long story short, you have more melting of the ice you see around the North Pole. And that ice is shrinking very, very fast. And that's why nations are looking north so much, because this area is melting. It's now accessible, you know, accessible for mineral, oil, and gas extraction, shipping lanes, you name it.
Well, Neil, you were talking earlier about how your first camping experience was on a massive ice sheet, where, you know, many of us here in Utah, we camp all the time. But I loved your section in the book where you talk about the rules of the Arctic and what it is to actually be there and to camp there. And I found it fascinating when you were talking about how it takes a bit for you to adjust to just the scenery and the topography. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one thing we don't always appreciate, particularly those of us who live in a built environment, of how connected to the planet we really are. And we are connected to the planet through many cycles we just take for granted. Light and dark is the most fundamental thing. You know, we're connected to that light-dark cycle when we know it very well, when we travel somewhere else and we have jet lag, right? But, you know, there are times we realize it, but for the most time, we take it for granted. When you pop into when you go to a polar landscape, you know, high latitude, you know, days in the summer are 24 hours long. In the winter, it's dark 24 hours. And all the cycles are different. And all the ways we connect to the planet are different. Like how we judge distance. There are no trees. There are no poles. There are no buildings. It's like being at sea. You cannot judge near and far. You know, is that a polar bear at a kilometer or is that a bunny rabbit at 20 feet? You know, it's one of those things. You know, you're always like, whoa, there's a white dot there. What is that? Is that closer part? You know, but that gives you a sense. And also the Arctic has sounds and Antarctica have sounds. The wind is incessant, right? So, you know, and your brain is trying to make sense of those sounds. And the ice has sounds, too. The ice can sound like sizzling bacon sometimes as it moves. It can make booms like thunder and you look to the sky, but no, it's below you. You know, there are all kinds of sensory experiences that are disconnects for us like that. And it takes a little while to get used to that in camp. But once you do, you kind of plug into it and it changes you, right? You're just plugged into it and you feel the planet, your connection to the planet. It's I recommend it.
Well, as these areas warm and more of the ice melts and more discoveries are being uniced, if you will, do you find more and more expeditions going to these areas?
They're hard to get to. So it's not like we have a whole ton of competitors working there. But yes, there are. But the here, let me give you an anecdote which answers your question in a different way, which is, I led an expedition to Ellesmere Island looking in rocks 380 million years old for more fossils this past summer in July. And we were going to a new place. And so to prepare for it, a couple years ago when I was doing the preps, I pulled out the aerial photographs that were taken by planes during the Cold War. They'd fly over these areas and take pictures, big pictures, beautiful. I mean, incredible high resolution, done by the Canadians and the Americans for military reasons. And then I compared those photos taken in the 50s and early 60s to the satellite photos, which you can download right now, you know, from my computer, and that were taken, you know, weeks before the expedition. And the melting was dramatic. Whole areas of rock have been exposed in the six decades that since those pictures were taken that contained fossils. So the expedition that we ran this year, part of that expedition would have been on top of ice 60 years ago, which is now it's bedrock that has fossils. So yeah, it's much more of it is exposed for work. We're not seeing more activity there just because it's so expensive to work there, and it's also, you know, it takes a toolkit to be able to work there, kind of the know-how. And so it's a very small community. I'd like it to be bigger. I'd like it to be a whole lot bigger, honestly. I'd love competition up there because that's competition is good for science as it is for business and technology. But, yeah, so we're trying to foster that community up there.
Mm. We're speaking with biologist and paleontologist Neil Shubin about his book, Ends of the Earth. It was funny, when I first saw your book, Neil, I thought it was, you know, sort of the doomsday book until I saw it was ends, plural, ends of the earth, meaning the polar ice caps, the polar scape. So you talked about your own adaptability to spending large quantities of your time there. And you also talked about how different sea creatures that reside in this area have this adaptability. You talked about living where there is no light at all, and also about kind of this antifreeze that fish develop. I often wonder, you know, when you see these things living in such severe temperatures, how do they get this and how do they create it in their bodies?
Yeah, so the subtitle of the book is, it's called Ends of the Earth, but the subtitle is Life, you know, Journeys to Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. And I look at life and its special adaptations to live there, and then what we learn about the cosmos and then the future, obviously, which is embedded in ice. But life there has adapted, as you say, in so many remarkable ways. And it's not just fish, it's all kinds of invertebrates and other things that have antifreeze proteins in their bodies. And what these natural proteins do is they stop ice crystals from forming, or they stop ice crystals from attaching and damaging cells. And these happen multiple times, and they're usually like a modification of another protein that the animal had before. It's like a liver protein in some of these fish that had a couple mutations that turns it into an antifreeze. So it's really, really amazing. But there are other adaptations as well. So there's one adaptation creatures have where they'll make a sugar called trehalose. And the sugar will replace the water in their body. That's what these roundworms do. And they'll turn into a kind of a glass, a sugary glass, almost like a candy that's brittle. And they'll stay in this suspended state when the weather gets really dry and cold. And then when it, you know, stay as this glassy state, they'll go into it. And then when the weather changes, they'll thaw out and, you know, carry on. It's crazy. But, you know, it's just one adaptation after another. And antifreeze is one of the biggest ones that we see in a lot of these creatures. But, you know, there are others too. You know, you see polar bear hair and muskox hair and even the shapes and sizes of their bodies. You know, nature has done so many wondrous things. And just seeing how these animals cope with these extremes is really remarkable.
Of the wondrous things that you have found or learned about by all of these polar expeditions and the study you've done, what is the thing that has most blown you away that also tells us about our own future?
Okay. Imagine you're with me on expedition and we are in Antarctica looking for ancient fish in the fossil record. And we're standing atop a mountain that's 7,000 feet high. And below us is the polar ice cap that extends for hundreds, if not 1,000 miles and a couple thousand miles in each direction. And we're at the summit of this mountain and we're cracking rocks. And inside those rocks, we find sharks and fish and some fish that are closely related to us. And we look at the sediments of those rocks, and these rocks were clearly formed in ancient rivers and streams, kind of much like a lot of the rocks you have in Utah, in the West. Imagine that juxtaposition between present and past. Inside the rocks is a tropical world teeming with life, adapting to tropical ecosystems. Outside, you're on top of one of the trans-Antarctic mountains surrounded by ice. The juxtaposition between present and past is so extreme, is so extraordinary, and it shows you how much our planet can change. And then when you study that ice, you see that that change can happen very, very, very quickly. So we see the past and the juxtaposition between present and past, but also knowing ice, you see the future. You see how the rapidity that change can happen will affect each of us, and so that's in a nutshell, that's kind of the beauty of the place.
Well, as humans, our perception of time is so limited to what we know. But when you talk about finding fish fossils and dinosaur tracks in Antarctica, and we look at that continent as being a frozen landscape, but at one time it was a tropical paradise, if you will. Where was that continent located at that time?
Yeah, so the continent at the time those fish fossils were laid down was a little bit more north, but it wasn't at the equator. It wasn't north enough to say, towards the equator, say, oh, it's warm because of where it was. Really, what the climate of the Earth has changed. There was, at that time, there was less latitudinal variability in temperature as we have today. So for most of the history of our planet, there was no ice at the poles, which is remarkable. And so we can tend to think of ice at the poles because that's our human experience. But the reality is, if we were to take a time machine and go to pretty much any other time period on the planet, you would not find ice at the poles. Now, there are times when the Earth is frozen, of course, but they're relatively rarer than the times when it was a lot warmer and the poles were pure liquid. There was ocean at those poles. So, yeah, I mean, so there are two things that can change that. One is the continents move around. But Antarctica hasn't moved that much in the relevant time period to explain that. The Arctic islands actually have. So it's they've behaved very differently in that way.
Now, before we let you go, and we're out of time, but I just have to ask this question about you, your exploration there, and what you are excited about exploring, and your excitement is so palpable and contagious, is about the ice melting and what is discovered there. What scares you about that? Because, normally this is what we hear about, climate change and the ice caps melting and what the ramifications are. So I'd love to hear the other side from your perspective.
Well, I mean, I'm going to put it more or less challenges for us as together to work. And that is, as the ice melts, and it's melting much more. So just to use Greenland as an example, the ice is melting about 280 gigatons per year of ice is melting into water. That's a lot. That's up from about 40 about 20 years ago. So at an ever-increasing rate, there's water in the oceans. What concerns me is that as that water enters the oceans, we are changing the planet. That sea levels will rise. We don't know how much. It's hard to predict the future. Sea levels will certainly rise. The question is how much and over what time frame. But as that happens, global sea currents will change. You can change global weather patterns. But we're already changing the geography of many places. Pacific islands are sinking. We're seeing changes to coastal regions. So we're seeing changes to the planet. And one thing you learn when you do field work is you see your connection to the planet in a powerful way, which I don't see. I live here in Chicago, and I'm not seeing my connection to the planet, right? But, you see it, and you feel it. And, when that's laid bare, what happens is you start to see and feel what will happen if that ice changes, and what happens as coastal regions change, as weather patterns change, as perhaps agricultural belts move. We're in a changing world. We're in a changing physical world. And how we adjust to that, that's up to us as a species, but it's definitely going to change. Times, they are changing a lot.
Our guest is best-selling author of Your Inner Fish, and now he has just released a new book, Ends of the Earth. It's Neil Shubin. journeys to the polar regions in search of life, the cosmos, and our future. There's so much, Neil, that we didn't even get to talk about today. So I guess that's why we'll all just have to read your book. What a great book. And how fun to have you join Cool Science Radio. Thank you so much.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
On Cool Science Radio, we enjoy bringing stories to our listeners of women in science whose stories have been lost until now. We believe it's a way to turn people, and especially young women, on to science. Our next guest has made a career of doing the same. Olivia Campbell is the New York Times bestselling author of Women in White Coats, and she returns with another fascinating story of pioneering women who changed the world. It's called Sisters in Science, and it tells the story of four physicists who were forced to flee Nazi Germany during World War II. Olivia Campbell, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad that you mentioned young women. Those are my favorite reader letters that I get when I hear from teen girls and women that are just starting college, or people that say, oh, my daughter is about to start college in this science degree. Oh my gosh, that's why I do what I do. I love it.
Well, it's wonderful because I think we have been made to believe that women just didn't do science. Women didn't just go to university and get degrees in the same types of fields that men did. But in fact, they did. And so a book like yours, Sisters in Science, is a really wonderful way. You know, these books, of course, like Hidden Figures, which we all know because it became a great movie, there were these stories, and we just need to tell them. And so you're doing this. Why don't you go through naming all of these four women who you highlight in the book?
So my book is about Hedwig Cohn, Lise Meitner, Herta Spohner, and Hildegard Stücklen. They were all incredible physicists. The three H-name ladies were all specialized in spectroscopy within physics, and Lise Meitner was a nuclear physicist. So they, you know, they're working alongside Einstein. They're you know, they're colleagues with household names, but yet we've never heard of them. I was very intrigued to find these names. I discovered them by looking in this database that Northeastern University had collected of all this information about women academics during the Nazi reign. So they were trying to figure out who was getting the funding, who was getting the money to escape, basically. What was the point of the research, but they included all these great data points about all the women. And I found these women that worked all, you know, they're all physicists, and it turned out that they all knew each other at some point, right? They had all met. And by the end of the story, they've all helped each other escape, and they're working together at new physics departments. So fantastic story to stumble upon. But I was just could not believe that the level of that they were working at, and that we hadn't heard most of their names. Some people probably know Lise Meitner. She's probably the best known of all of these women, but the other women, I sincerely doubt most people have ever heard of them. But I have photos of them sitting with Einstein, you know, just hanging out, chilling. And, you know, they worked with him. They worked with all kinds of, you know, the top physicists of the era. And, I wanted to shine a light on their intelligence, their brilliance as well.
That's wonderful. Well, did as physicists and as educated people, as the pressures and the tensions are mounting in what would become Nazi Germany, what was the relative ability to move about the country and to, you know, foresee what was happening and then, you know, hatching plans to leave? Was it an escape, or was it that they had more ability to travel, to leave, to move?
So it's different stories for all four of them, right? So two of them are Jewish and two of them aren't Jewish. They all lost their jobs because of Nazi edicts because they're women. So let's see, we have Lise. She held on to one of her jobs for longer than most of them. She was working at University of Berlin and at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Chemistry. She's the head of the physics department there. So that's not a public school like the university is. So everyone gets fired who is Jewish from public service jobs, which included almost all universities at the time. So if you were Jewish, you're immediately out of a job, 1933. So that was Hedwig and Lise, who were both Jewish, and they immediately lost their teaching positions. Hedwig was able to get a job, sort of a private job, private industry job. She stayed in her Breslau University Institute. They gave her kind of a back room that was hidden so the Nazis wouldn't find her if they came in. She continued to do work offsite for this lighting company until she was the last one left. She was desperate. It was desperate for escape. We finally see her escape. Took many, many months to travel to safety. But then we have Herta and Hildegard, who are not Jewish. So her employment hinges on her boss, right? So she has James Frank, Nobel laureate physicist. He's her boss, her mentor. He brings her along when he moves from the KWI to another university. And at that university that they move to is a man who does not want women in the university teaching. He doesn't think women should be professors, should be scientists. So James Frank says, as long as I'm here, Herta will have a job. Like, she'll be safe. You're not going to fire her. She's good. But James Frank is Jewish. So, 1933, he, instead of waiting to get fired, he quits and said, very publicly, and says, I will not use my intelligence to support the Nazis. I'm leaving the country. This is not acceptable, what you're doing. Makes a big public show. So then, Herta totally out of a job after that because, now she has no protection, no safety, which is a story I found in many, many other women in the same position, women academics, who they had this one man to vouch for them at an institute. As soon as that person gets fired because they were Jewish, the women are no longer safe. They no longer have a job. And then come these edicts from the Nazis that really make it impossible for women to hold a position anyway, really make their workplace situations really anti-women. Hildegard, finally, she is working in Switzerland at the time that the Nazis come, and which sounds safe, right? But it's not, because the Swiss government starts getting really worried about what's going to happen. They don't really like foreigners being there. They don't want to renew her contract at the university she's at. She has to fight really hard to stay. And then she's like, okay, she sees that she's about to lose her position. So then she's like, I need to get out of here, but I'm definitely not going back to Germany because I'm not a pro-Nazi either. I'm not gonna be able to find a job at a university, let alone want to work in Germany. So she also flees to the US. So definitely the two Jewish women are the ones who did not have a lot of mobility around the country that are being monitored. Their actions are, the Nazis are regularly checking up on them. We have Lise, the SS, taking up her case personally, really looking into her. And even though Herta wasn't Jewish after she left, because Frank's leaving was so public and because the press started looking at her when she went to Norway initially. So we had the press in Norway like lauding this new woman physicist coming, and then she's branded an enemy of the state by Germany because she's another public scientist who fled.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Olivia Campbell. She's the New York Times bestselling author of Women in White Coats, and she is returning this winter with another fascinating story of pioneering women who changed the world. And the book is called Sisters in Science. Well, let's talk about these women specifically. As is typical for most women scientists, we don't know anything about them because their stories have never been told. So one, it's great that you're telling this story, but I was fascinated about reading about Lise Meitner. She was a nuclear physicist. She was the second woman at her university to get a doctorate in physics. She was nominated for the Nobel Prize 19 times for chemistry and 30 times for physics. I mean, that's a big deal. What did she end up going on to after she had to flee Germany? Because while she was in Germany, she obviously had this amazing, research CV that she was working on.
The Nazis really sort of ruined her career, honestly. They, she's in her late 50s by the time the Nazis are coming up, and she's very set. You know, she's head of the department at this huge institution. She's a full professor, one of the first women full professors in Germany. That's a big deal. There's many levels of professor in Germany, and that was huge. And then she had a, you know, tenure, she had a pension, she had all this, you know, guarantees, and she was set. She loved her research group. She loved her institute. She had her lab set up all the, you know, exactly how she liked it. Everything was where she wanted it. She really tried to stick it out. She wanted to stay in Germany. You know, she at the beginning didn't want to believe it would get anywhere near as bad as it did. Nobody did. I mean, that's, you know, it was unthinkable at the time. So she also didn't consider herself Jewish because she had converted to Christianity as an adult in her 20s. So she didn't identify as Jewish and didn't really understand why the Nazis were identifying her as Jewish. But you know, they didn't care what church you went to. They only cared about your heritage, your ancestry, what was in your DNA. So she was designated as Jewish because her grandparents were Jewish. But she was absolutely incredible. Like, I think that we would know her name if she had said yes to the Manhattan Project. That's what I think. I think that Oppenheimer got the glory because he said yes. She said, I think she deserves more glory because she said no, because she was brave enough to say, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it. I know she could have done it.
Well, and she also did not share the Nobel Prize with Otto Hahn, who she had been a collaborator with. So just yet another example of women being dismissed. What was that work that she did with, what kind of work was she doing with Otto Hahn that won him the Nobel Prize and not her?
That's a quote about her, is that she's most well known for earning Otto Hahn the Nobel Prize. So she started this research project. This was her baby many, many years before Hitler comes along. So she ropes Otto into this project. He's the head of the whole KWI for chemistry. He's a chemist. And at first, he doesn't want to join this project. He's like, I don't have time to do it. I'm too busy as the head. And so finally, he joins her project. So this is several years worth of research. You know, it takes many, many years to get to find a notable finding. So right when they're on the cusp of this discovery that changes the world, right, discovery of fission, nuclear fission, is when Lise finally has to flee. She can't stay in the country anymore. She's going to be deported. She's going to be, you know, put in a camp. It's not physically safe for her to be there. She finally acknowledges this and leaves to Sweden. She tries from Sweden to continue this project with Otto. They're writing letters back and forth as best they can. A lot of letters are being opened and read. So they have to be very careful about what they're saying. They have to pass a lot of letters between friends that are traveling freely and that are Jewish. It's Lise that finally realizes what happened. So Otto has this problem where he's like, I can't explain this reaction that what's the end point of this reaction, right? Chemistry can't explain it. Within the known laws of physics and chemistry, I can't figure out what is going on, right? He admits this, like, what's going on? You know, what is this, Lise? So she's walking with her nephew, who's also a physicist in Sweden. He's come for the holidays to visit. They're just chatting about this. She can't let this go. And they kind of talk it out. They figure out what's going on, that the atom is splitting in two. Unbelievably, this was not even thought that could possibly happen, right? Maybe one or two people had said, oh, maybe this will happen, you know, in the past, but they've never really, you know, put any kind of, it's a crazy theory, you know, it's brushed off. No one's thinking this is something that could really actually happen. So she writes this paper up with her nephew. She's like, we're going to call it fission. She names it. It was her project all these years until the very last few months of this project. It has been her project. So because the Nazis, you know, pushed her out of the country, she didn't get the credit for this, right? Because Otto's writing his own papers back home. He's publishing. He's the one that gets the credit. It's not really safe for him to acknowledge her role at first because that might put her in danger. But even when the Nazis are defeated, he sort of downplays her involvement And the third person in their little research group is just like so angry at him for downplaying, you know, her role, yeah, because it was her baby. It was her finding. And during the First World War, they had done a project together. They discovered an element together, and he gets all the credit then, even though he was out fighting for half of the time and she was the one in the lab doing the research. So even whether she's there or she's not there, she's never getting the credit. And it's so frustrating to me.
Wow. Well, you know, I have a question about that. We recently spoke to the writer Davis Sobel, who I'm sure you're familiar with, and she wrote a recent book about Marie Curie, and, you know, who did win the Nobel Prize several times and who the world knows about. In fact, she may be the only female scientist that we could all name in a trivia game. And so, I mean, had the Nazi occupation not taken place, do you feel like Lise Meitner would have gotten the credit that she deserved? I mean, and how was it different with Marie Curie? Why did she get it? And after all of these dozens of nominations, Lise didn't.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it was any anti-Semitism that was keeping Lise out of the running. Or I think some of the biographers of Lise that I've read posit that they didn't really know what to do with her because a lot of her findings spanned chemistry and physics, and they weren't really sure which category she went in. Like, they didn't really know how to define the work she was doing, which is really seems like a silly reason to me. Like, just pick one and give it to her, right? She definitely deserves it. I don't know why Marie Curie is more famous. I haven't researched her as much. My monthly newsletter about women in science is called Beyond Curie, not to downplay or belittle anything that she accomplished, of course, but that there's more people out there, right? There's so many more stories that we don't know. And, you know, I love Dava Sobel's writing. She's incredible. Yeah. Her books, she's the queen of women in science.
Well, even she, though, in her book, part of the reason she wrote the book is she wanted to highlight some of the other women that Marie Curie worked around. And so, like you, she's trying to, you know, tell these other stories that we may not have heard of.
When we started the conversation, Olivia, you were talking about these funding and grants and opportunities that were created to bring scientists over to help them flee Nazi Germany. I think that's a fascinating thing that the scientific and university worlds realized that there was a huge potential to lose all of this talent. Tell us about the programs that helped bring these women over, whether it was here or the UK or wherever it is they ended up.
So this point in history is called brain drain from Germany. So Germany said, you know, Jewish thinkers are subhuman, right? What they say is all lies. We're not going to believe them. There was a rally against the theory of relativity, right? Like, that's the level that they were at of anti-science because it was by a Jewish thinker, right? So, yes, the international community saw a definite need and an opportunity. We have all kinds of different organizations, crazy acronyms going on of funding organizations for emergency help to get Jewish people out. A lot of those are academic focused because they knew it was going to be a lot easier to get academics out. There are special visas for professors in certain classes of better educated people, which is in and of itself problematic, but at least we can save some of these people a little bit easier, right? But for the women, it was not that easy because they'd been held back so much in Germany. They weren't allowed to go to a university for a much longer time than men. They weren't allowed to become professors for a much longer time than men. So by the point the Nazis come along, women are still, you know, often unpaid assistants. They're just teaching a couple of classes. They're not full professors, that, you know, because the universities are sexist, because the structure of the universities is sexist. So on paper, these women don't look very good to the international, you know, or hiring organizations, any colleges abroad that could potentially save them. The women are definitely not looking good, not to mention that, you know, most universities in the U.S. weren't going to be hiring women as a kind of blanket policy in the first place. Mm-hmm. But at least we have women's colleges here who were often the ones that were like, okay, yes, we will save this person. And then you add on top of that a layer of suspicion about, oh, are they a spy? Are they a mole? Are they plants? What are they going to, we can't let them too near, our, especially with the physics. So, you know, we don't want them to learn about what we have in our physics over here and then share it with Germany. You know, so many layers keeping them out. But yes, at least there were the funding for academics.
Yeah, in reading about Hedwig Cohn, she ended up, like you say, at a women's college at Wellesley, and, you know, which was wonderful, and then went to Duke, not just a women's college, where I think she ended up spending the rest of her life and dying there in Durham, North Carolina, or Raleigh, whichever. So that's another one that she was very interesting woman and made so many contributions to the education, higher education in this country. Can you just give a little overview of Hedwig for our listeners?
She's my favorite. I always have a favorite. I write a book so far. I don't know. She was just adorable to me. She's so tiny and just so like happy seeming, before the world comes crashing in on her. She's got this indomitable spirit though, that's just, she just keeps trying, and all of that she went through to, you know, weeks away from being deported, finally gets the visa to escape. She goes to Sweden to stay with Lise for a little while. Lise helps her get visas and helps her get funding. And then she travels on to America. This like 3 month, you know, ocean voyage. She's on trains, she's on boats. She gets really, really ill and kind of falls out of the train into James Frank's lap. And, you know, Herta and James are there to help her. But she, you know, finally gets well and starts teaching in the US. And the stories from her students were just incredible. Like she's just so inspiring and still has such an amazing spirit. And just, I think it made her feel really grateful, you know, to still be alive, to still be working in her field. It really was a hugely life-changing experience. I'm sure that she would have loved to stay in Germany, just like Lise. She had a great position. She had a great lab. She was teaching students. She had a patent for this lighting technology that she and one of her students put in. So, you know, she was an incredibly intelligent, just an incredible physicist. And the fact that she then went on to share that love of really specialized higher physics with American women students was very cool to me.
Well, Olivia Campbell has been our guest, and her new book is called Sisters in Science. It's the story of four physicists who were forced to flee Nazi Germany during World War II, and so many more stories that we didn't get to talk to, so folks will just have to buy your book. Olivia, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been my pleasure.
And thanks for tuning in to this rebroadcast episode of Cool Science Radio. And that was truly, truly Katie Mullally's final episode with Cool Science Radio. You can always find our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab in Cool Science Radio, or wherever you get your podcasts, KPCW Cool Science Radio.